Hello, welcome to another episode of The High Ground, powered by Premier Companies. Jeff, how are we today?
I'm doing great, Sal. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, too.
That's awesome.
Who do we have today? Well, a returning crowd favorite. He's got so many followers now. When are you going to have Glenn back on? We have our agronomist, Premier Ag Agronomist, Glenn Longaball.
Good morning.
He's the king of corn. King of corn.
Yeah, I think that's taken. I think that might be Bob Nielsen.
Okay.
All right. Well,
I like the way you're thinking.
You're the prince?
Yeah, I could be a prince.
You'd be a prince. Okay.
Yeah, you know, my pronouns are he, him, I'm supposed to be a princess of corn.
And flagged again.
We're flagged again. We had to start out right out of the gate, right?
We'll work on getting you a crown, okay?
Thank you.
Well, slash. Let's work on the question of the day.
Absolutely.
All right. So this is, I think we're all over 50 here. And barely, right? Mid-50s, at least. What is your best back when I was your age go-to story?
Man, I have so many of those. You know, the older you get, the more you use that, right? But I've got a good friend, right? And he's constantly giving me grief about my endurance, right? And it's like, man, when I was your age, yeah, I'd have walked your butt off in the mountains so quickly, because I used to really pride myself when I was younger. You know, I've always been an avid hunter, but I spent some time out west when I was in college and feel pretty comfortable in the backcountry and have done a lot of backcountry backpack elk hunts, mule deer chasing, that sort of thing. And, you know, used to really pride myself on my endurance in the mountains.
Stamina, yeah.
Right? And eyesight, right? You know, whenever I was an All-American, I never had to use a spotting scope to pick my knocks out at 90 meters, which is like 98 yards or, you know, 98 yards, 2 feet and a few inches, right? Just short of 100 yards. And I could pick my own knocks out. And today, you know, if I don't have cheaters on, I can't see my telephone or my computer. It's 3 feet in front of me. So, yeah, there's a lot of back in the day I could really see this, that, and the other. So, but yeah, it's time catches up with us all.
It does.
I think all three of us have our cheaters. Yeah, cheaters out.
Nobody gets out alive.
Jeff, yeah. What was yours?
Mine is probably, I think my favorite thing to talk about is my first car phone. And it was not a mobile phone. It was, you know, huge box, you know, bolted down in the trunk of your car. You had to schedule a time to go in and have it installed. Then when you change company cars, you had to go schedule a time to have it de-installed.
Analog.
Oh,
it was pre bag phone then.
Power inverter.
Pre bag phone. Yeah.
Yeah. It
was mounted in the trunk, had a big pedestal up there on the floorboard.
Oh, yeah, I remember
those. You had great service. Those are full 3-watt phones. They were great service.
Sure.
If you were in an area that had service.
Sure.
Had a fan on it because it got hot, probably.
God. Yeah. Yeah, bag phones used to get really hot.
Yeah.
They did.
$600 a month phone bill, probably.
Absolutely.
Or more.
People have no idea.
Those were the good old days.
Those were the good old, all that analog power going right into our heads.
But even with a cell phone like that, or car phone, you know, I traveled the whole state of Michigan and Northern Ohio. I also knew where every drive-up payphone was back when you could still find a payphone.
And you had a calling card. Yeah,
you pulled up and you dialed in your AT&T, you know, long-distance code.
Yep.
And, yeah, you could sit there and make calls.
Yep.
You know, setting up your next call of the day.
Yeah.
Or call me after a certain time because the rate's cheaper.
Yeah. I almost completely forgot about calling cards. Yeah. I still remember mine
from the Marines, 677-190. That's all we had.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's better than quarters.
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, I remembered customer. I still know a lot of my old customers from my chemical rep days. I still remember their business line because you didn't have automatic redial. You had to punch it in every time.
Sure.
The full number. And
oh, absolutely.
If you got a busy signal, you punched it in again.
Yeah.
Isn't that funny? I remember numbers I haven't dialed for 30 years.
Mm-hmm. And now with ours, I can't tell you all my kids' cell phone numbers because it's on speed dial.
I couldn't tell you my dad's. It's all saved.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Well, mine would probably be, you know, I get a chance to help out with basketball and a few other things with my daughter being in sports and stuff. And to hear kids say they're tired. I'm like, gosh, when I was your age, I didn't even know what tired was. Or right. What, I was never hot. Do you ever remember being really hot or cold when you was a kid? Never.
No.
Yeah.
Sunscreen, never had it.
Yeah. That's true.
Drink out of the garden hose?
Of course.
We didn't have water bottles.
Well, you had to rinse it off because it was stuck down the water trough.
Yeah.
No. You had the good hose and you had that hose.
Yeah, there's. Yeah.
We could just do a whole episode on this.
Oh, we probably could. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Oh, just get off memory lane and let's go talk about what's going on in agronomy. What's current events?
Yeah. Lynn? So, well, there's lots of current events in agronomy, right? And, well, in agriculture in general, right? It's been a tough year, not yield wise, but commodity wise, it's really been a tough year. And we just had an election and everybody's excited to see what that will, you know, what will transpire in agriculture. And I'm cautiously optimistic, right? Last time Trump was our president, he did a pretty decent job of trying to, create a trade balance with China and other countries. And if he had any extra revenue, he'd kind of push it our way. I don't hear that same level of intensity out of that camp, right? I was in high school when Jimmy Carter was president.
Embargo.
Yeah, and he did a lot of the same things that
talk about
that,
when I was
yeah
when I was your age.
Yeah, and when you have a cheap money policy, when you have policies that create cheap money and inflation, that initially is really good for agriculture. But when you go to reconcile that, like we did during the Reagan years, that is not particularly good for agriculture, right? And that's kind of where I see we're at, right? We just came off of a very liberal, very progressive policies to now probably going to be more conservative. And it makes me a little anxious as a grower, especially when we've got, a little over $4 corn and not quite $10 soybeans or right at $10 soybeans. It makes you very anxious, right? Until,
some of this you've seen before,
Absolutely. It feels like deja vu, right? It seems like, I've been to this party before. I didn't get spanked by it, but I did get out of college in 1985. And man, I'm telling you, 1985 was about as bad for agriculture. In fact, some economists that adjust for the value of money will tell you that the mid 80s were worse for agriculture in this country than the Great Depression. Yeah. So
high interest rates.
Absolutely. That is one of the big differences today between the early 80s is we don't have the big interest rates, right?
We don't like the interest rates we have.
Yeah.
Because we were spoiled for several years. But
at least they're not 16, 17.
18. Yeah. But, that kind of brings us, today's topic is probably going to be around biologicals, biostimulants. Some of these, it's almost like alternative medicine for agriculture is probably the best way to put it. And it's not to say that, that these products don't have some value, right? We have plenty of examples that work, right? When you think of Bradyrhizobium japonicum, it's the inoculant that we use to create that symbiotic relationship between soybeans and a bacteria colony. And, that's been very successful. And we only supply, typically the nitrogen that we supply to soybeans is either fixed through this symbiotic relationship, or it's just leftovers from a previous crop, or it's the degradation of organic matter, right? We really don't supplement any nitrogen at all on soybeans, which happens to be a leguminous crop, right? And is a very intensive user of nitrogen, right? You consider what we remove from soybeans is protein, and one of the key components of protein are amino acids, and the building blocks for amino acids are amines, right? It's nitrogen. So soybeans will use 4 to 5 bushels of nitrogen, or excuse me, 4 to 5 pounds of nitrogen is what's required to raise a bushel of soybeans, right?
Wow.
There's been some great, you think about Bacillus thuringiensis, that may sound familiar. That was where they basically gleaned the genome to allow for corn borer resistant corn, right? We think about BT corn, some of the first transgenic corn, some of the first products that they put traits in to make them insect resistant came from a naturally occurring soil biome called Bacillus thuringiensis, and it basically was a bacteria that made certain orders of insects, primarily Lepidopteran insects, sick at their stomachs, right? And it became economic because it was screwing up silkworm. It was screwing up silk production, right? It was killing silk larvae, which is the larvae, the worm of a Lepidopteran insect. And that's how it was discovered. And it's still used today in vegetable crops as a, I think the brand name is called Dipel. So, been lots and lots of great examples of biologicals and biostimulants working. But we've kind of entered in this time where it's become the Wild West. And, you know, people see this as another revenue stream. And
they're everywhere. I mean, you get calls all the time. Oh. And it's like from some new company you never heard of, but every one of them is going to increase your yield.
Absolutely.
I think if you put enough of them on, you'd have, 500 bushel corn because every one of them has got 10, 20 bushel.
Yeah. It's like planter attachments, isn't it? You got to have just this next thing. It'll put 3 to 5 bushel on it.
Yeah. Right? So there's so many of them bombarding us that, and I know I don't understand them at all.
Sure.
And I'm not farming, so I don't have to, and I'm sitting there thinking, I used to have $6 corn. Now I got $4 corn, and these guys are all wanting a piece of the pie. I don't know if I have a piece of pie to offer them. So how do you make sense of this?
That's a great question, Jeff. I mean, you're talking about a segue, right? That is exactly the peril, right? When I think back to the mid-80s and when it was really tough before, these products kind of had a revival at that time because they oftentimes are less expensive. Right. And so it's not about using them in addition to, oftentimes these folks get to talking about replacing things like mineral nutrition, replacing different pesticides. And that's
do that for a while.
Yeah. Sometimes you can. Sometimes you don't even get by with it the first year, right? Look at organic farmers. They typically organic farming is such a misnomer, right? People think that they think of organic farming, they think of no traits and no chemistry, and it's inherently safer. And it's almost just the opposite, right? I can't think of anything that is harder on the environment really than organic farming, right? Because you almost have to use tillage, right? And we use tillage, we have what? We have erosion. Yep. You have erosion. What goes off the field with the erosion? Well, what'd you use for fertility?
Probably
manure, right? Yep. And you have huge amounts of sediment, huge amounts of erosion that's full of animal waste going into the water supply. Yeah. That's, it's not sustainable at all. And yet, for people that are not familiar with agriculture, that's what they see as being the future of agriculture, right?
They think they demand it.
Yeah, they almost demand it in some cases, right?
You know, talking about the 80s and how we're having kind of flashbacks, but I mean, we're talking about people coming to market and saying that this product will replace NP or K, or there was products back then that claimed to replace tile. I mean, they sold soil conditioners.
Absolutely.
And people, whenever things are tight and you're wanting an answer that only costs $8 or right. $4, the temptation is just—it's almost too much.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that before we hear some of the things and the events around this, but at Premier Ag, we are a cooperative system, and we work for the co-ops, work for the farmers, owned by the farmers, and Jeff said it. We get bombarded with stuff, and now we steer these to Glenn to get the stamp of approval, and Glenn said, when these things first came out, that there was not the amplitude or the frequency of response to warrant the application in a lot of times. And until we see that, I think a better way to say is you said, we can see there's something there.
Correct.
Right. But how much is it and how consistent is it?
Yeah. So, when I think about biologicals, we've already talked about how crowded the field is, right? I mean, there are becoming not hundreds, but thousands of companies, right? That all have some microbe that they, that they have some science, right? And sometimes it's even peer-reviewed studies that say that Bacillus amyloliquefacients, for example, has these antibiotic, antifungal, nematicidal, right? It has these properties, and we know that it has these properties. But there's a big difference between saying that it can do these things and then having any kind of data that supports that that is implementable in the field, right? One of my first, when I first got to Winfield, Dr. Brown, you know, very early on, he set me aside and said, look, right, there's all these things that we'd like to do, right, that we know are better for the crop. But eventually, you have to boil it down to something that is implementable for a grower. In the case of all these, these products, right, it is not that they oftentimes don't do. Well, there's a lot of these products that they don't even really, they don't know themselves what it's doing in the plant. For some, they have enough insight to know that it is protecting the roots. It's causing a signaling of flavonoids or whatever, right? They have some small understanding of what it's doing in the plant, but most of them have no, when I say most of them, nearly all of them have little or no data that is replicated across any number of sites that would suggest that their products really work with any kind of consistency. And part of that is because we're talking about living organisms, right? And so when I think about biologicals, you know, one of the things that Winfield United, right, which is our, I guess we'll call it our mothership, right? It's the, you know, it's the cooperative, right? If those listeners that are familiar with Land O'Lakes or Winfield is an arm of Land O'Lakes that sells input products to cooperatives like ours, right? And they do a great job oftentimes of taking these kind of high level tasks on, like, well, how are we going to manage around biologicals and how do we differentiate between them? And how do we sort out? I mean, really, the audience today is growers, right? Our job or my job is to help sort out what the heck is real and what is foo-foo dust, right? Yeah. Because it's entirely crowded. And unfortunately, most of these products overpromise and underdeliver, right? Yeah. And so when you think about from that standpoint, this is what Winfield United was trying to bite off, right? Trying to chip off. And so one of the things they did was they decided to categorize and create a program called BioVerified, right? So when you think about biologicals would suggest that it's a living organism. In reality, a lot of the products we use that are called biologicals are not really living organisms. They are the byproduct of a living organism, and oftentimes they stimulate the plant, right? So we probably, the first bifurcation we need is the difference between a biological and a biostimulant, right?
That's good.
Organic acids, PGRs, those things are biostimulants. Bacillus amyloliquefacients, Bacillus firmus, mycorrhizal fungi, right? Those are true biologicals. So you almost need to make that segregation.
So
to
those
start
are
with.
The true bugs in a jug.
Right. They're the true bugs in a jug. And
you need to find that a little further, what a biostimulant versus more of a what they do is that?
Yeah. So when we think of biostimulants, probably one of the biggest categories right now would be humic and fulvic acids, right? And some of the contest winners have used those successfully. Folks that are in the Western United States on sand have used those successfully. In our neighborhood, I can't say that I've ever seen any appreciable advantage to using humic or fulvic acids. If I was going to use one here, it would probably be a fulvic and not a humic, right? And both of them are derived either from rotted plant material or from leonardite, which is, that's what it is also, right? You think about a seam of coal. At the very top of a seam of coal, bituminous coal, is this layer of kind of, it's called leonardite. It's basically a mineral that's like half digested plant material, right? Hasn't been compressed into coal, but it is still full of lots of these organic compounds that came from megafauna right? That were, it was here on this planet, you know, prior to history. Right.
Wow.
And so they take this product and, if they use the initial cut, that's called humic acid. And it does have a really high cation exchange capacity, right? So you could make that argument that, yeah, we could potentially, we could nest or harbor, cations in this matrix of organic chemistry. And then if you take the lower molecular weight, right, the smaller molecules out of humic acid, whether it's derived from linardite or whether it's been derived from, you know, some kind of rotted plant material, those smaller fractiles, those smaller molecules, lower molecular weight molecules are typically called fulvics, right? And they oftentimes contain organic compounds that stimulate plants even more, right? But I mean, that category is pretty wide, right? You think about seaweed extracts, right? The ancient Romans used seaweed that they pulled out of the ocean as fertilizer for plants and realized that there was some benefit there, whether it was from nutrition or whether it was from these organic compounds that made plants grow more vigorously, right? They recognized that, you know, roughly 2,000 years ago. Wow. Right? So it's not like these products haven't been around for a while, but it's more about the amplitude, right? How much can you gain by putting on humic acid? How much can you gain by putting on fulvic acid? How much can you gain even using hard chemistry? Like, you know, we have products that contain cytokinetin, that contain gibberellic acid and indole-butyric acid. And these are either the same compounds, the same plant growth regulators that plants use to signal the shoot from the roots or the roots back to the shoots, right? And we can use those to manipulate and make plants grow more vigorously, but that doesn't necessarily equate to an economic benefit in yield. No. You know, we know how to exploit it at Premier because we've used it a long time and we've had a lot of instruction from the folks at Winfield. And we know that when we use, you know, things like Ascend, which is this combination of plant growth regulators along with a source of zinc and a source of phosphorus, we know that we can get a more lasting response, right? We don't just get an initial, we don't have an initial burst of vegetative growth and then the plant goes backwards, right? It's this combination makes for a better stand and a more vigorous seedling that typically equates to, you know, some value and yield, right? Pretty high frequency. I think that if you just use the PGR alone, it's probably a fairly modest frequency. In fact, it may only be 50, 60% of the time do you see an increase. But if you use it in combination with zinc, you use it in combination with zinc and phosphorus, then you get up there in the, you know, the 80 plus percentile of positive frequency. And the amplitude is probably in that 5-6 bushel range, right? Hmm. And so, you know, that's the kind of data you really need to make decisions on this. And that's not what we're getting in the countryside, right? In the countryside, it's mostly anecdotal. It's oftentimes combinations of microbes. Most of the time they're bacteria because they're easy to culture and they do get a response. And I'm not here to say they don't do anything. Without question, it's soil biology contributes in large part to the kind of yields and the productivity that we have. But most of that is not supplied by us. It's naturally occurring, yeah. Right? When we raise corn and soybean systems, typically we fertilize those. If you want, you know, there's a lot of talk around soil health, and yet it's really hard to define soil health. But I can tell you this, right? Typically, when we think about soil health, we're looking at how much CO2 is being recirculated in the soil, right? Most people agree that should be the measurement, right? Is how much carbon, right? How much life, how much growth is there in the soil? You show me a soil that has poor fertility and poor drainage, and I'll show you very little. I'll show you very little soil health. You show me a soil that has good fertility and has good drainage, and I'll show you a soil that has great soil health, right? And yet, which one of those has been intensely managed? The one that has internal drainage, the one that has been raising 250 bushel corn, it will almost always have more exchange of carbon. It'll have more biological activity, right? I remember visiting with some guys from SDSU, South Dakota State University, that had been over to visit Francis Child's operation, right? And Francis Child, prior to this modern group of contest winners, Francis Child was kind of the king of corn productivity. And they were suspect, right, that Francis was really raising the kind of corn yields that he said he was raising and he was documenting. And, of course, he was turned in by his ex-wife for cheating, right, leaving some and kind of soiled his reputation. But I don't know that anybody visited that farm that didn't go away from there saying, you know what, whether he cheated this year or not, there's no question there was something unique going on. And the guys with, you know, SDSU, they were suspect because they're like, look, he doesn't get enough sunlight over there. He has too many cloudy days. We have, you know, we're going to go into irrigation and we're going to put on rainfall. You know, we're put on water without, you know, all these cloudy days. And there's no way he should be able to out yield us. And it's like, really? And that's accounting for this, and this. And I remember saying, well, the only thing we can't account for is the fact that he has about 6x or 10x the microbial activity in the soil that we have in our part of the world, or that we've really documented almost anywhere else in the country. Now, some of the things you need to know about Francis Child was, prior to him becoming a contest guru, he had put on huge amounts of hog manure for lots and lots of years. Probably 20 years of hog waste had gone onto that ground, was my understanding, right? I don't have that history, but it was like a lot of contest winners, right? They fall into one or two camps. They fall into, they're irrigated and they spoon feed and basically are running a Haglin solution every day, or they come from an area where they have a huge buildup of mineral nutrition. And typically that comes from what?
Manure.
Yeah, it comes from animal waste, right? And so, and this is kind of another one of those unsettling things that you see right now is you have these contest winners that have maybe made a living out of selling their wares,
sponsorships.
Yeah, being sponsored by biological companies.
And then paid to repeat it.
And then they turn around and they're really quick to point out that, hey, and we're really good stewards, right? We're not using hardly any nitrogen. Well, no, but you've got, you know, you've got this huge reservoir of organic nitrogen over here, right? And so it's not really applicable to what most of our growers are doing, right? If I was going to consult a grower, you know, these are tough times. We all are trying to find a new notch in our belt, right? I mean, it's not like we're just going to tighten our belt. We're looking for new holes.
Yeah.
But there are some things that are absolutely mandatory, right? You can't raise corn without nitrogen. You can't raise corn very many years, or soybeans very many years, without P and K, right? So those things are absolute table stakes, right? There's no microbe, even if it increases the availability of phosphate or potassium, or releases some small amount of nitrogen. There's no microbe that's going to appreciably replace mineral nutrition, because we farm in an open system and we're constantly removing N, P, and K. When it comes to crop protection products, right? Yeah, there are alternatives out there to the top shelf crop protection products, whether we're talking about corn herbicides or soybean herbicides, but man, we are having trouble controlling things like water hemp and Palmer amaranth, even with our top shelf products. And so you can imagine trying to put together, using second stringers to try to beat a world class, world class weed. It's just pretty hard to do.
They come with their own issues, whether it's the absence of a safener. Whether it is even the pesticide mixing and handling.
Absolutely. I had that conversation on the way here this morning.
I had one. I was talking about the Atrex versus the atrazine and Syngenta's formulation of Atrex versus some of the generic atrazine. And people, we tend to think that these products are so old that, well, it's all the same, right? It's just the different jug, or it's not always that. That's not the case.
Sure.
And I use some of my personal experiences of the flaking and the settling of atrazine in containers.
Yeah, the one I had this morning was around mesotrione, right? And those of you that are familiar with Callisto, you probably recognize that we've had plenty of problems historically getting it to mix with just everything, yes. Right? I mean, you have to be very cautious. It's a suspension. It's an SC formulation, a suspension concentrate. It needs to go in earlier, make sure it's completely bloomed in. But even when you do everything right, occasionally you'll have a mess, right? Well, just imagine if you've gone from Syngenta formulated mesotrione, even if it's in a private label brand like Incinerate, to something that is truly generic, right? And you don't know whether it was made in India or whether it was made in China. You don't know if it was three witches, you know, standing around a cauldron going bubble, bubble, toil and trouble. I mean, you know, that actually makes me lose sleep thinking about the potential messes that we can have, because it's a hard chemistry to formulate, even when you are the original manufacturer of mesotrione, right? And so
I've got another one on the, I'm so old. Yeah. I can remember dumping in bags of Atrex.
Absolutely. Was that, 80. but that was 90. Yeah. That wasn't 80W.
Was that 80W?
That was probably 90. I'm assuming it.
It was 90. Yeah. Yeah, that was 90%. It was kind of water dispersible granule. Before that, they had.
Well, we had 80W in the early 80s. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah.
So you did dump bags. They came in little bags, right? Yeah,
they were little 10 pounders. Yeah. 10 pounders?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was convenient because it would just float there on top of the.
That's exactly.
It would just, you dump it in and look at it.
Well, we would put it through an inductor and, you know, the old liquid suspension fertilizer days. And so
jam it through the broom handle.
That's how old I am. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, what's funny is there's artifacts from that yet today, right? When people, if you talk to an older grower and he says, I want 2 pounds of atrazine. We really don't ever use 2 pounds of atrazine. We use 2 pounds of 80W equivalent, right? Which is actually 1.6 pounds of atrazine. And so when we use liquid, liquid atrazine formulations, typically we're using, 4 pound product. And so we're basically using 1.6 quarts or 1.5 quarts typically is what we're using. But that's how long the tail is on some of those things. So it's pretty interesting. You know, I'm having a hard time keeping my computer up over here, and there was some stuff, right? We were,
Well, you got your password right there where you can read it on the top.
No, well, it's coded, man. It's encoded.
Oh, it's coded.
It's coded. And I've, I got my cap lock approved. Well, there's a reason why I had this up, right? Is, there's some things I want to make sure I covered, right? We were talking about biologicals and biostimulants and it's a crowded field. It's ambiguous. And typically, they overpromise and underdeliver. But, just recently I had an article sent to me from Jason Roth, one of my peers up north, right? And we all love Jason Roth. He's an agronomist for Keystone Cooperative. And basically it was an article from Marshner Review which is in a scientific publication, right? Called Plant Soil, right? And Marshner Review was named for Horst Marshner, which was a pioneer, made a lot of contributions to plant and soil science and that interaction between plants and soil. But anyway, I thought this was interesting. The opening, right? In the abstract, it says, despite more than 50 years of research, no robust evidence suggests that the inoculation of cereals and other non-leguminous, free-living, and or endophytic bacteria leads to the fixation of agronomically significant quantities of dinitrogen, right? And so, dinitrogen gas from the atmosphere. And so, what this publication is, what the scientific community is finally, trying to reconcile is, hey, it's interesting to know how all these things work, but eventually somebody needs to be responsible for the fact that people are using that information to lead growers down the road to purchase things that really don't have a significant advantage to crop production, right? And that's where we're at, right? So
they're using breadcrumbs. They're following this. It does this, and then that's next to that's absolutely. Similar to this activity, right?
Absolutely.
And that's how they get to the answer.
So I thought that was probably worthwhile. I mean, the title of the article is "Science is Science Losing Its Way," right? And basically it cites these examples from infixation products, right? Whether that's Invita, which we have represented, right? We don't make big claims about it. We don't promote it heavily, but we do represent Invita. You know, you think about, there's plenty of products on the market that basically flood the airways, right? And basically tell growers that they can replace 40 pounds of EN. And that just is not true, right? And so in the 21st century, I can tell you that, you know, that we all are, you know, we all have a phone strapped to our hip, and we are beneficiaries of an unbelievable amount of information. But a lot of that information is not very well sourced, right? And so maybe the best... you know, maybe the best way to leave this is I've quoted this before because it seems to be more applicable all the time, right? So when it comes to biologicals, it reminds me of a sermon I heard once on 2 Timothy, which was a letter from Paul to Timothy, and I think it's in chapter 4, verse 3 and 4. It says, "A time is coming when people will turn away from sound teaching, and their itchy ears will have them seek out prophets that tell them what they want to hear."
Oh my gosh.
Right?
Yes.
And you think about it, that's almost exactly where we're at today, right?
2,000 years ago.
Yeah, 2,000 years ago. Of course, they wrote that about, you know, about Christianity and other basically religions coming in and trying to taint, right? Trying to spoil, you know, basically the message of Christianity, right? They didn't want that tainted, but it's really applicable to where we're at in agriculture.
Applies.
Yeah. It's very applicable to where we're at in agriculture today. So
if I'm a grower today and I've been bombarded with all this information and I'm really leaning towards, I want to try something.
Yeah.
You know, I guess what I'm hearing from you is the jury's still out.
Yep.
They're probably worth playing with on a small scale to try to figure out, you know, is there something that stands alone, or do we need to figure out, hey, we need to add this and this? So, I mean, what would you tell that grower today?
Yeah, I would tell that grower to make that the last dollar spent, not the first dollar spent, right? Make that the last dollar spent. And really, I would go to a football analogy. Man, in football, it's not, it doesn't matter how good you're, and I'm not a football guy, but I understand football enough that I understand when they talk about blocking and tackling, you can have a really good offense, but if you don't have a defense, you cannot win. You can't have a championship season.
That's a good way to put it. There's a whole series of things of potash, nitrogen, phosphate, weed control, fungicides. There's a whole series of things to get right.
pH. Absolutely. And it starts with seed, right? I mean, if I was a grower and I want to know what is the magical combination,
of course, it's fertilizer.
I love that about you, Jeff.
So single-mindedly
it
focused.
Is. And you know what? That's funny. We probably in my
chicken or egg. Come on.
Yeah, in my personal opinion, I probably put on fall fertilizer before I make my seed decision, right? I may obligate to seed, but I don't pick the varieties probably until after we've already put on P and K. So you're probably not far off.
That's why he's our favorite.
He just made my case.
I know.
But for most growers, right, the first decision is you got to have the best seed, right? And then you got to be able to support that seed with fertility, right? And if you don't have things like drainage straightened out, maybe this isn't the time to go till, you know, or you know, not till, tile, but it's certainly a good time to think about maybe improving your surface drainage, right? Those things absolutely will make a bigger impact, right?
Those are the fundamentals.
Yeah, just the fundamentals.
That's the blocking and tackling.
Yeah, it's a blocking and tackling. You can't raise great big crops and you can't be competitive in the market if you have weedy fields, right? Weeds remove a lot of bushels. And so you got to have good
nutrients.
You got to have good crop protection. Yeah, it's competing for water, it's competing for light, and it's competing for nutrients. You know, you can't raise a great big crop if the crop dies prematurely. And one of the biggest problems that I see with folks that are not independently wealthy, and even some that are independently wealthy, is that when it comes to in-season management, those in-season management decisions need to be made before you're in season. Why? Because that's the time of the year when you make terrible decisions, right? When you're in season and you're trying to decide whether you're going to make a nutritional application or a fungicide application or an insect application, some of those things have the most profound impact on yield of anything we do during the year. And when are we making it? At the time of the year when we had the least cash on hand. And so we're almost looking for reasons. Well, gee, it's a little bit dry, or, oh, I think that we're going to get toad strangler. Oh, this is, you can, as a grower, you can find a million reasons not to spend another dime. And so I would tell growers that this is a great time, right? While the chemistry is cheap, tie it up. If you're going to prepay for something, prepay for those inputs that are hard to turn loose of in season that you know have a profound impact. It's like me. I don't particularly like, some people love to side dress. They love to drive through their crop. They love to see, you know, every square inch of the ground. Side dressing is probably one of the single most stressful things I do in the course of the year, because one, I have a day job and with you folks, right? And in addition, I'm almost never done with planting.
Yeah.
And it's just one of those things like, oh my gosh, this has to be done. Cause what happens if I get a big toad strangler, you know, some big rain event and I can't finish it. Right. So there is this anxiety when I'm, and I also don't like to run over corn, right? Because, you know, if you really wanted to get the advantage out of side dressing, you need to make that application when the crop is in peak demand, right? Or going into peak demand. Well, to do that, you need to delay it, right? And if you delay it, then you have a smaller window. And if you get a big rain, it just, so these things, and I've seen every, because I'm an agronomist, I've seen every possible thing that can go wrong, right? It causes me huge anxiety. And yet when it's done, I can't think of another thing I've done to my crop that probably has a bigger impact on yield than going in and side dressing, right? It allows me to produce the most bushels on the least amount of nitrogen because I'm putting it out there following the four R's, right? I'm using the right rate. I'm using the right, you know, which is significantly less. I'm using it in the right form. I'm doing it at the right time and I'm putting it in the right place, right? And, and if you follow the four R's, it will make you a better steward of the environment as well as the crop. So,
well, anywho. I think that's a,
I got one more question.
Yes.
Shoot.
So on the biologicals, I think we agree the jury's still out.
Yep.
Do you anticipate, hey, over the next couple of years, I'm going to figure this out? Or do you think this is going to be a long-term?
Yeah, it's certainly going to be a long-term play. I am very confident, right? You know, these nitrogen fixing bacteria that were supposed to work on cereal grains, just like Breeder Rhizobia works in soybeans, right? Leguminous crops is a perfect example. Was there something there? Absolutely. Did it become quantifiable? Yes, right? We can go in and tissue sample and we can tell at V8 that there's a higher level of nitrogen. Sometimes we can increase the nitrogen to the point where we actually see sulfur deficiency, right? It will induce, right? Wow. If you get carried away and you get the N to S ratio out of whack, you'll oftentimes induce that sulfur deficiency. And Purdue University has seen that, right? In Tony Vine's data, a couple of years, he saw this sulfur deficiency. So we know that it works, but is it? It's not that these things don't work; it's that they're exaggerated. So sometime down the road, will we find things that give us a high enough amplitude that they're really a step change? Absolutely, but they're never going to replace mineral nutrition, right? We're an open system, right? Your supplier, Jeff, mines phosphate in Florida. They break it down with phos acid, right? Which they make from phosphorus and ammonia. And they break it down and put it in a form that will dissolve or will dissociate and leave dihydrogen phosphate available to the plant. The plant takes it up, the plant puts it into grain, right? It's one of the highest harvest indices of any mineral nutrient we have is phosphorus, mm-hmm. right? Typically 70, 80% of what we put on, that amount will go away with the grain. Does that grain get put back on the field?
No.
Absolutely not. It goes through a hog, a turkey, a sheep, a cow, whatever. And then that manure goes somewhere else. Yeah. And that's where this phosphate goes. And so it's an open system, right? Bob Beck said one time, we were having an argument, and I know I've told you this before, but we were having dinner and we had a fellow there that had worked for the Defense Department in microbes, right? In microbiology, probably working on weapons, right? So you always want to be respectful of those folks. And he was basically, you know, he was wearing me out with, you know, hey, we're going to use this microbe to do this, and this microbe's going to do this. You know, honestly, it was so sophisticated, I couldn't keep up, right? Because he knew all of the different microbes, and he was very conscious. And he kept using a forest ecosystem as his example, right? We don't add fertility to a forest ecosystem, and yet it can, you know, it
thrives.
Yeah, it thrives and produces all this biomass. And finally, I elbowed Bob Beck, right? Dr. Beck, which some of our listeners, a lot of our listeners might recognize. Bob's retired down in Arizona now. But anyway, I elbowed Bob, and boy, he was just shoveling away his dinner at the time. And he puts his fork down, looks up from his plate and says, well, I'll just tell you right now, when you get that 147 people that we feed on an acre of ground to eat, sleep, and poop on that, then
that'll be a closed system.
It'll work. But until then, it's an open system, and it's not like a forest ecosystem. And I'm telling you, the whole table, he didn't say it quite that way because it was quite a bit funnier, maybe more vulgar, but it was a lot funnier. And it's absolutely true, right? And so we need to remember that. Our growers need to remember that. Our listeners who are not familiar with agriculture that think that we're trying to poison them by pulling, you know, potassium chloride out of the ground and spreading it across the ground, allowing it to dissociate, allowing the microbes to fix it into other organisms, allowing it to get tied up into the clay colloids, and feeding a crop to production levels that allow us to sustain, you know, 7.5 or however many billion people we have on this planet. Trust me, we're doing the best we can to do what's in humanity's interest, right? We really are. It's probably, you know, what we do in agriculture is probably next to baby being a minister is probably about as noble a cause as you could ever have. So, yep.
And I think in summary, I think that you said something with the group yesterday. You said we're not so prudish that we are not going to continue testing these things.
Absolutely.
And we will test and use our own data in addition to data that's brought to us to see and use our own insights that we find out.
Absolutely. So, absolutely.
All right. Well, Jeff, anything else?
No, I think that sums it up well.
Glenn, thanks as always. We appreciate your insight on all this and also the humor and the stories.
Yeah.
One of these times we're going to tape and record the conversations we have before the podcast.
There you go.
So, I don't think that's allowed.
Yeah, probably not.
Very good.
Well, that's another episode of The High Ground, powered by Premier Companies. Thank you very much, and please like and subscribe.